Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
With this episode of the podcast, we're going to get really geeky, even geekier than normal, because we're talking all about car handling. Now, we have done a podcast on a sort of similar topic, the art of road testing cars. There will be a little bit of overlap, but if I look at my notes now, I can see how much different ground actually there is for us to cover. Andrew, we've been inspired to do this episode of the podcast off the back of what appeared to be a very palate cleansing drive in a Caterham.
Oh, it was just lovely, you know. just on the handling thing, I mean, to me, that's what driving pleasure is about. It's not really about going fast in a straight line or anything else. It's the way that a car feels, and that is, to me, what handling is. And, you know, and after all this nonsense we've all been going through for goodness knows how long, what, since lockdown in March, just to get back into a car, that car being a Caterham Super 7 1600, and just to have it all stripped back to what actually matters about driving a car, it was quite literally a breath of fresh air, but it was also, I kind of just fell in love with driving all over again. And what struck me about this car was, and we've said it about things like your A110 and GT86s and others, that, you know, when it comes to it, you know, as I said, you don't need a huge amount of power. Actually, you don't need a huge amount of grip either. And sometimes huge amounts of grip can get in the way. And I just took this little Caterham, you know, 135 horsepower, 1.6 litre, four-cylinder Ford engine, doesn't have a limited slip diff in it. It really is the simplest, most basic form of that kind of motoring. And I just whizzed it up to the mountains and back yesterday. And just thinking to myself, you know, somebody said, well, this is it. This is all you ever get to drive for entertainment's sake. I would be so cool with that. I would just, you know, because the feel of the car, the way that it responds, the way that it interacts with you as a driver, because it is light and because it is precise, and because it is low, and because it doesn't have a huge amount of grip, and because its characteristics are so wonderfully neutral, all these things which we will, I'm sure, get onto in time. To me, that's what driving is all about, far more so, I have to say, than, you know, harrying around a track in a 1,000 horsepower hypercar. So that's where I'm with it. So I'm sort of, I had a kind of a bit of a road to Damascus experience yesterday. Although, well, I didn't already know, but it's always an education to be reminded of that sort of thing, and, you know, the kind of feels and sensations which made you fall in love with driving in the first place.
Yeah, and as cars get more and more complicated, it's so handy to be reminded from time to time that simplicity actually is best when we're talking about, you know, the pure aspects of ride handling, steering, It's simplicity and lightweight that's sort of key, isn't it? Let's just do a couple of minutes on that K-trim, because I haven't driven one. I've driven many, many K-trims of, you know, different flavours, but not this one. Where do you stand on the sort of retro styling? Do you like that stuff?
I do, I'm afraid, yeah. But that is a kind of slightly personal thing, because the first K-trim I ever had, which was before I got into this business, basically looked identical to the car that's parked outside at the moment. Right down to it also being red. Those long flowing wings. I just love the look of it. I like the look of it from the outside, but I love the look of it from the inside. I'm a complete sucker for that. And I know people will go on, but they generate too much lift. I'm not sure I really care about that, as long as the thing stays on the ground and stays stable, which certainly at the sort of speeds you're going to be doing on the road, it does. I love it. And if others don't, they don't have to have that. They can go back to having they can have the normal cycle wings.
While we're talking about K-trims, there's such special and sort of individual things to drive, just because they're so light, they're so small, they're so simple. They steer beautifully. I mean, you'll drive a 911, you think, well, this steers well. Or, you know, you might even drive an Elise and you think this drives well, but then you'll drive a K-trim and you'd say, my goodness, this is what steering can be like when the fundamentals are right. And it's not just the steering, it's feel from every corner, every inch of the car. It really is like a big go-kart. You just can't fail to be hyper aware of what the car's doing, how much grip there is in reserve, you know, all this stuff. And I think that's what makes K-trims in particular brilliant cars to learn to drift in, to power slide in. I've done a few of those sort of experience days in, it might be the lower paddock at Brands Hatch or just a huge open car park somewhere, and you're skidding around cones in a 7, and it's brilliant. And you learn so much. And then, you know, you move away from the paddock at Brands and onto the circuit. They're great cars to learn to race in as well. And I've been fortunate enough to do both of those things. If you enjoy driving, it's just an experience that you have to tick off, isn't it?
They are the kind of sort of ultimate trainer, aren't they? Because, you know, obviously they're incredibly well balanced, but because they are so light, there's not much momentum. So when they start to go, they never go very far, because there's not much car to gather up. And that means, you know, that gives you the confidence, which allows you to think to yourself, well, okay, the moment it starts to slide, maybe I'm not going to sort of go into sort of crisis management and just try to recover it. Maybe I'm just going to try and go with it and ride it out and extend the slide and actually start to drift the thing. And you're absolutely right. That's how you learn how to do that kind of thing, which is why I guess all the sorts of places that you ever go to learn that sort of thing all tend to have K-trims out the back. Another thing about the K-trim, and this may surprise you, but one of the reasons that I absolutely love this car is because it is so practical.
Yeah, go on.
You weren't expecting me to say that way, but it is. I mean, stand that up. You know, you and I love things like atoms, and the Atom 4 to me is an absolutely fabulous car to drive. But as we also know, you know, if it rains, you get very wet regardless. You have to kind of wear a helmet if you're driving it on the public road and on and on and on. In a K-trim, so I was up in the mountains yesterday. We did a little photo shoot on the car, and just as it finished, the heavens opened. And I just popped on the side screen, tacked on the hood, got into it, turned the heater on, turned on my heated front windscreen, and I was snug as a bug. I really was. I was, you know, I couldn't have been happier. I'm 6'4". There was lots of space for me inside. This wasn't, by the way, an SV. This wasn't the big chassis. This was a standard S3. Chassis, and I could have driven it as far as you like. It's a car that you can use, you know, regardless. You're not sitting there thinking, oh my god, well, you know, the forecast says it's going to rain for an hour at 3 o'clock this afternoon, so I better not take the car. If it does, continue. There's also, you know, there's a little bit of luggage space. It does just enough to turn it from being a real sort of, you know, fair day and holidays type once in a blue moon excursion car into something that you can really use. And you know, and I've probably said this before on a podcast, but it is kind of my mantra that, you know, how enjoyable a car is not just how much fun it is to drive. It is how much fun it is to drive multiplied by the number of times in which you get to drive it. And that is what I think, you know, Caterhams do so well. So there you go. That's my little treatise on how practical Caterhams are.
Well, yeah, I completely agree with you. Having that hood, it doesn't look like much, but it makes the car usable when it's raining.
And the heater on the front screen, and the heated front screen. You can just, you know, you don't just steam up in there. It's absolutely fine. The wipers work well. Little stuff like that, because I guess it's such an old car, such an old design, it's just been evolved and evolved and evolved over time. And it's kind of got to, it's like the shark, isn't it? You know, they reckon the shark has stopped evolving because it has reached its hydrodynamically optimized shape. And I think the 7 actually got there a while back, didn't it? They just can't, within the format that they've got, they just can't make it any better than it is. So they kind of just leave it where it is, which is fine by me.
And money no object, would you have a really powerful supercharged one or the most basic one you could find?
Oh, dear. I'll tell you what I would have. I'd have a car which doesn't exist. But, you know, to the extent, I mean, you know, I'm thinking very hard about this. I am thinking about, not that I can afford this and I don't know how I would do it, but I'm genuinely toying with the idea of saying, can you do... So the Super 7 is the sort of oldie worldie car which I've been driving. That's the one with the flared wings and the spare wheel cover and the mini lights and all that sort of stuff. And you can only get it with a 1600. Now, you know, I'm not taking back everything else I said about back to basics and everything else, but because I know me and because I'm a bit of an idiot, I just know that if it had 180 horsepower instead of 135... and a diff. I know I'm slightly contradicting myself here, but just go with me. So what I would like is a car which I don't think exists, which is the old world style, but with a 2-litre donkey in it. So I don't want an absolute whiz-bang, supercharged, up-the-wazoo sort of thing. Yeah, a nice 180 horsepower, 2-litre Ford engine, but in that shape, with a diff, I would just shut up and love it forever. I really, really would. But I don't think you can buy that car at the moment. Whether they're going to go and do it in the future or whether I can persuade them to do one for me, I don't know. And I don't know how I'd pay for it, but I've got it bad. I've really, really got it bad. I was on Piston Heads last night just going... Oh, the other thing, the other one that I want, and this mustn't turn into a Caterham podcast, but an old red top, you know, with a 2-litre Vauxhall engine, because that was such a good engine to have in a Caterham, because it sounded brilliant running through twin 45 Webers. It had about 175 horsepower, you know, straight out the box, absolutely unbustable, wonderful performance, great noise. And if I can't afford, or if they can't persuade them to make the one that I want today, then I'd go back and look at a sort of 20-year-old one of those. Anyway,
very good.
Sorry, sidetracked.
Yeah. Just a little bit. Well, if I had space, a garage or some, you know, a lockup or something, you'd have to have one in your collection, wouldn't you? So last word on Caterhams. the one that you drove in kit form was about £33,000-£34,000.
It's expensive.
It's pricey. Yeah. It is. It is a fair amount. Although you have to look at it in sort of context of its residual values, you know, unless you're going to keep it forever, I suppose, because the things barely depreciate.
Yeah, it's true. It is absolutely true. And this is what I'm convinced. This is the man mass I'm going through right now, because I'm thinking to myself, well, they don't depreciate much. Maybe I could get a bunch of mates to help me build it. And money's really cheap to borrow at the moment, and yada, yada. And the next thing you know is I'll just have gone and done it. You know, who knows? But
there we go.
I really, really want to.
Okay, all right. Well, I think we got sidetracked for quite a long time there, didn't we? Let's get back to the topic at hand. So it's a big question. What is handling? Do you think we can answer it briefly with something like the car's ability to execute the instructions of its driver, something like
Yes, that is absolutely it.
Okay.
That is what I have always regarded handling to be. It's absolutely not whether it oversteers or understeers. Those are all probably quite minor facets of handling. It is, as you say, it is a car's ability to execute the instructions of its drivers. And you'd be kind of amazed at how cars, even modern cars, fail in that simple regard. And, you know, you only have to, you know, everybody should do this. They should take whatever they drive and go to a roundabout, a quiet roundabout somewhere, and do not skid around it. Just drive around it at a completely normal speed. And because roundabouts tend to be circular, what you should be able to do is enter the roundabout, put a steering input in, and without moving your hands, circulate that roundabout until the cows come home. And if your car doesn't do that, if it starts running wide or tucking in or whatever, then it's not going where you think or want to point it. And that means your car isn't steering properly, which means your car is failing the absolute first responsibility of a car chassis, which is to go where you point it.
Yeah, it seems basic, doesn't it? But
yeah, but you'd be amazed at how many cars can't do that.
Yeah. Okay, so that's sort of the core underlying principle of handling. But what are some of the fundamentals, some of the basics of good handling? We think balance, good chassis balance, proper weight distribution, you know, for the type of car in question, I suppose.
I mean, for me, it goes, well, I mean, it depends how back to basics you want to go with this. I mean, you know, before you get to any of that, things like, is the driving position laid out properly? Is the steering wheel actually in front of you? Are the pedals where you want them to be? Can you heel and toe properly? Are the controls where you need them to be? You know, if you're constantly having to take your hands off the steering wheel to reach things that you need, and I'm not talking about skidding around tracks here, I'm just talking about driving the car, then, you know, to me, that is as big a part or aspect of handling as anything else is. Visibility. I mean, oh my goodness, you know, if you can't actually see out the car, and we may have talked about this before, but I mean, I had a particular experience where, don't feel too sorry for me, I drove an SVJ Aventador after a 720S McLaren. And it was like getting out of a goldfish bowl and peering through a letterbox. And when you've got a huge, intimidating car like an Aventador and you can't see out of it properly, it really intimidates you, and it knocks your confidence. And certainly cars like that, all cars are really, you know, the ability to inspire confidence, excuse me, in the driver is, you know, as important as it gets. But particularly the bigger and the faster and the more powerful cars become, the more important that is. And to me, you know, if you can't see out the car properly, if you can't see over your shoulder, then, you know, that is a mark against the car's ability to handle, because it just gets in the way. I don't know if we're going to get on to things like steering wheels and that sort of thing, but, you know, again, crucially important considerations. But I think, you know, in the terms that you describe it, in terms of the actual balance of the car, you just want a car which doesn't do anything unexpected. And what it does do is fundamentally benign. I always go on about linearity. I would always rather a car which, if it were to break away, did so quickly, but in a linear fashion, than one which might break away slowly initially, and then suddenly you get into, you know, this yaw gain moment where the rate of lateral acceleration suddenly increases and you don't know where you are. And suddenly you've got to start moving your hands at different speeds to collect the thing. And, you know, and you and I can both think of cars that behave like that. You know, whatever it does, it must be progressive. That's quite a long answer to your question, isn't it?
It's good, though. Yeah, actually, on that point, so I'm thinking sort of 80s supercars and even sort of slightly more recently, Renault Clio V6, something that you think you've got on, you've got balance, and then it'll just get away from you.
And then it's just gone, yeah.
And I suspect during this podcast I'm going to mention my own car, my Alpine A110, a few times, because one of the wonderful things about that is it's so progressive. Actually, it can oversteer quite quickly, but particularly the way it slips into understeer, it's so progressive that you can really fling it into a corner, knowing that it's not just going to wash out and immediately send you understeering into a hedge. It will do that gradually, and then it's sort of balanced and poised enough that you can come off the throttle and it would tuck in. The way that it breaches its limits of grip very gradually, particularly in understeer, is just fills you with confidence.
Yeah, and that's actually, you know, apart from it being good fun and confidence, it's actually a safety thing, isn't it? You know, I can remember, you know, engineers saying to me, asking somebody, I think it was on the launch of the Tourist 7 GTI, which is obviously going back a bit, and just asking why this car just understeered. And whatever it did, it was just shades of understeer. And if it understeered a lot, all you could make it do was understeer slightly less. And it being explained to me that this was safety because you didn't want cars that oversteered. And I just completely disagree with that. You know, if you are running away, you know, wide from your apex, and maybe you're about to stray onto the wrong side of the road, you want a car that will oversteer. You want a car that will bite back into the apex. And you want a car that will do that. You know, if you've got no more front grip, and so you can't do it with your steering, you want a car that will do that just by restoring that front grip by coming off the throttle a bit. And that, to me, is as much a facet of safety as it is of fun. And you're absolutely right. Cars like the Alpine, which just do it so naturally, you find yourself not even thinking about it. You just find yourself steering the car on the throttle without ever thinking about it, because it becomes as natural a way to drive the car, particularly if you're on a track or if you're on a particularly good and quiet piece of road, as using the steering wheel. You're just constantly, you know, you set the general direction, don't you, with the wheel, and then you trim the car with your right foot. And that, to me, is the joy of driving. You know, when you're doing that with a car, then you're really having fun. And it's one of the reasons that, you know, I don't think that grip is the way to go, because it makes that more difficult, because A, you've got to be going a lot faster. And, you know, obviously in the context of public roads, you just get to a speed where it's just not either safe or even sort of socially acceptable to be doing that. So that lovely balance and that lovely experience of just feeling a car just gently sort of adjusting itself according to your commands is removed from you, and all you have is grip, and, you know, and so you just lose that one fundamental component of driving pleasure.
I had a very interesting experience, a sort of salutary lesson in the importance of feel recently. And feel is such an overused word when talking about car handling that it's lost all meaning. It's just become a vague term. But for me, it's a really important one. And things like, you've mentioned it already, but the thickness of the steering wheel and visibility, it all comes under the same banner as feel. And I'm not just talking steering feel, I'm also talking about the sense that of connection that you have with the whole car. And it all bundles up together into having a sort of intuitive understanding of what the car is doing beneath you. And this experience that I had recently that really made me go, oh, wow, okay, yeah, that is fundamentally important. I was driving a Mercedes AMG, the CLK 63 Black Series. This is the car from 2007-2008. Great-looking thing, really cool car. I was driving it in the middle of a storm in Wales on a sort of hillside road. Lots of standing water, wet road, lots of standing water.
Old tyres?
No, actually. Pretty recent tyres. But it was hard work and it was intimidating. In some ways, that car's got a really cool chassis. It's got quite trick suspension with manually adjustable dampers, and it's clear that particular car has clearly been set up really well, because it manages a difficult road, a very bumpy road, quite well. But it's got really taut, closely controlled body control as well, so it works well in that sense. But it had tires that didn't like a wet road, and certainly not standing water. It had probably the most hopeless steering I've come across for a long time in terms of sort of instinctive feel and intuition. It had no self-center when you're coming out of a corner, or even worse, if the rear is sliding a little bit, it had no sort of caster effect to dial in automatically some corrective lock. So, and, you know, and also when you put it into a corner, there was really no sense of it loading up and of the tires gripping and biting. So I had this pretty intimidating car with a shed load of power, and also it weighs, with me and a tank of fuel on board, around 1,800 kilograms. And I at no point did I feel an intuitive, instinctive sense of how much grip there was, how hard the car was working, you know, where the where the weight of the car was. And so actually it was not an especially enjoyable experience.
And if a car like that can't do that for you, then it just, you know, you wonder what the point of the car is, don't you?
Mm. Yeah. I suspect the conditions didn't suit it at all, but...
I'm sure, you know. But cars like that should be able to... I mean, I had such a similar experience with a rather more modern car, with the Project 8 Jaguar, which I'd driven on the road in the dry, and I wouldn't say I was blown away by it, but I could kind of see a place for it, and I thought it was fine at what it did. And then it rained, and we were up in Snowdonia, and we had, I think we'd been, no, we hadn't been on the track, but yeah, I think we'd been taking photographs, and it was one of those ones where, you know, you suddenly realise the bar's about to open, so everyone's legging it for the hotel. And it was wet, but it wasn't sort of, you know, it wasn't flooded or anything like that. It was raining, and there were parts of the road which were wetter than others. But I just lost all confidence in the car because I just didn't know where the nose was. I just didn't know where the front end of the car was and what it was going to do. And I ended up just bailing out of it and just, you know, sitting back and turning on the radio and not trying to drive fast, because the car was actually more pleasant like that, because I wasn't having to worry about it. And it comes back to the confidence thing, doesn't it? I just had no confidence in it. And it doesn't matter to me how fast the car is or how quickly it'll go around a corner. If you're not confident to drive it that way, then it's all rather academic.
Yeah, confidence is really the key word. When we talk about feel and visibility and all that stuff, it's just confidence, actually. That's what you can boil it down to, isn't it? And that's where Caterham 7s are so brilliant. They flood you with confidence. I feel a similar level of confidence in my car. In GT911s, you feel that confidence. And that's what's missing from so many, particularly this Black Series. And that, just as a sort of aside, we've mentioned on this podcast before that if you put a limited slip differential into a car, often... particularly if it's a sort of passive mechanical one rather than one of these trick electronically controlled ones, they'll make the car understeer on the way into a corner. But it occurred to me while driving this Black Series that almost what's worse than that is that it will make a car feel like it's about to understeer. And if that's your first instinct for having turned into a corner, you just think, okay, well, I've got no confidence in this, and I'm just going to back out. It's really unsettling.
It does. LSDs do get in the way. I mean, some cars obviously need them, but I completely understand why. You know, the companies whose reputations are for producing the finest chassis in the world, and I'm talking about Lotus and McLaren here, don't do it. They don't put LSDs in their cars because, for exactly this reason, because they. They make mid-engine cars, so, you know, and they have proper rear suspension geometry, so they don't need the traction. And what LSDs bring in terms of incipient understeer is not worth the effort. I mean, this little Caterham, I promise you I'm not dragging this back into the Caterham, because I'll only be doing this for a minute, but you know, it didn't have a diff. And okay, the only time it was frustrating was we were doing some cornering shots, and it just wouldn't drift. It just, you know, you just couldn't get it. You know, you could, if you went into the corner ludicrously fast, you could get the back out of line a bit just on weight transference with a big lift off. But, you know, that's, I mean, you're only doing that because there's a bloke pointing a camera at you. There's no particular fun in it. But at all other times, so if you were driving it normally, not trying to make it perform for a bloke, you know, holding a camera, I didn't miss it at all. I just loved the purity of the thing. And so to me, you know, the question isn't, does the car have a limited slip diff? It's, does the car need a limited slip diff? And if the answer to that is no, it doesn't, then I'd rather not have one.
Yeah, interesting point. Interesting point. So one of the things I want to discuss as we talk about handling is how it's developed to the point where it is now, because I sometimes sense that engineers and also the technology that's available to them has evolved to such a point that some cars almost have too much handling, or they're so competent at dealing with their own mass and gripping the road that you can find yourself hammering along in them. And this will be in a sports car. Actually, I've felt this in 911s, even Porsche 911s, particularly And this will open up a can of worms. When they have that Porsche dynamic chassis control system, the active anti-roll bars.
Yeah, it's completely pointless.
Yeah, and they that sort of technology, they make cars too competent. And what it means is they have such high limits that you can be barreling along on a road and feel like you're getting nowhere near the car's limit of grip. And so the car just feels aloof and distant. It's as though it's unimpressed with your efforts at, you know, extracting its performance from it. And, you know, it might give you confidence, but if a car leaves you feeling that you've got nowhere near it, then it's just as bad as a car that leaves you without, that makes you feel no confidence when driving it.
You're right. It is a balance. I mean, the sort of, I've used this over the years so many times, it's probably some kind of cliche, but you know, you want, you know, you're not, or you shouldn't be sitting there, you know, in the audience watching a performance on the stage. You don't even want to be, you know, the director. You want to be on the stage. You want to be part of it. You want it to be a two-hander between you and the car. And you're absolutely right that, you know, the faster and more competent cars get, the higher their limits become. So the more difficult they become to access, and the more clever the electronics are, the more removed from the action you often become. And, you know, I think that car engineers think that, chassis engineers often think that a car which basically turns around to its drivers and says, sit there, watch this, that's a good thing. And I think we have to acknowledge that for probably the vast majority of people, then it probably is, because if you put the limits so far in the distance, they're never going to be broached, and you make a car which is at least objectively very impressive, then people probably aren't going to get into trouble in them. And the sorts of stuff that we have talked about on this podcast, and the sorts of stuff that I hope that people listening to this podcast will resonate with, is not the sort of stuff that most people who go out and buy most cars have any interest in whatsoever. And they would think, well, hang on, so you actually want a car with less grip than more. How does that work? Isn't that dangerous? You know, why would you not just want limits as high as possible? Because, you know, more is better, isn't it? And, you know, people who read DN and subscribe to the podcast like this, no different. But, you know, I guess from the chassis engineer's point of view, job one, particularly when you're dealing with cars that are so fast now and have so much momentum, is that they must be safe. But the way that that happens does get in the way of driving enjoyment. Can we talk a bit about driver aids and what your thoughts of them are, how they should operate? I mean, you must have driven cars, and I certainly have, recently, where, with my hand on my heart, I would be quicker in them with some level of control, because they are so sophisticated that basically you can drive them around a track like your pants are on fire and be unaware of any kind of intervention, even though it might actually be doing a little bit. But the only time you become aware that there's this sort of guardian angel looking after you is when you make a complete horlicks of it and you find yourself running out of it, and then suddenly out of nowhere, you suddenly think, ooh, it's all right again. And for about a split second, you think, I'm a genius. And then you think, actually, no, there's something else going on here. And I certainly know racing drivers and chassis engineers who, in honest moments with beers in their hand, will tell you that they are quicker around the ring in the cars they are developing with the systems on than with them off. But we also know they get in the way, don't they?
Yeah, what you tend to find, I think, with, you know, I'm thinking quick McLarens and Ferrari Pista, that sort of thing. Yeah, with some degree of intervention. I think the manufacturers themselves will say that they're faster around a lap with the systems on to some degree than with them fully off, which is remarkable. And then you look at the sort of polar opposite approach taken by Gordon Murray with his T50, and he's developed the car to steer and handle properly without any intervention whatsoever. And then he bolts on a system just for safety purposes. Do you have a sense of which approach you feel more drawn to?
I just like having the choice. You know, I have, and I also like particularly cars that allow you to set them up the way you want them to be. And this is, I know this is going a bit beyond safety systems, but, you know, but then nevertheless is about handling a setup and that sort of thing. So, you know, it's great when, you know, you can, you have a menu and you can choose the throttle response that you want, the gearbox, if it's a paddle, shift speed, that sort of thing, damper settings, steering, all that sort of thing. And I want a car that I can configure the way that I want it to be. I also want a car which, you know, if I'm, you know, tired on my way back from far, far away and I'm not trying to drive fast, which is really got their eye on absolutely everything. So really, I just want to be able to choose. One of the things I love about things like GT racing cars is that they come with little dials for traction control and for ABS, and they usually go from about 1 to about 12, and you get this incredibly sort of fine ability to choose what you want. And, you know, you can find yourself, you know, as you grow in confidence in a car, you know, knocking one or the other back a click or two, and then suddenly if it starts raining, then you can, and it just gives you that choice. And I think cars should do that more. To me, it's not about whether the systems are on or if they're off. It's about allowing you to choose where you want them to be. I don't personally have a problem. I loathe systems that are never truly, well, that are obviously never turning themselves off and they're always getting in the way. Or systems, and there are some cars which still do this, which, you know, you can turn them off, but only under 40 miles an hour. And then suddenly you do more than that. They all come chiming back in because the car is presumed that you're too incompetent to control it, that sort of thing. But people have often sort of proudly said off means off. And I don't really understand why that's so cool, because if you get to a stage where a system's only intervention is to stop the car from crashing because it's recognised that you genuinely have gone too far, then that, to me, that
that's
has to be a good
problem,
thing, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's not really a problem. You know, if you've got to sit to a system where we have, where the car is quicker with the systems on than off, so the systems are frankly better than you. And if you think about it, they probably should be, because we are all humans and we are all fallible. Then, you know, why not? What I don't want are systems getting in the way. I want a car which I can drive. You know, I think about the SF90, and if you have that in whatever it is, CT off, that's a car which will, you know, you can literally run out of opposite lock. I can remember coming out the Fiorano hairpin in complete stability with my foot absolutely hard down and no more lock, thinking that I was some kind of superhero. But of course, what's happening is the car is just recognizing that state, realizing that my foot is still hard on the gas, and thinking, well, okay, so he wants to drift, so we'll let him drift. And it just maintains the angle. And I guess some would say, oh, well, that takes away the skill of it, which it undoubtedly does. But, you know, when you're talking about, you know, a 400,000-pound, 1,000-horsepower, four-wheel drive mid-engine Ferrari going sideways at goodness knows what speed, then, you know, I think that's probably, for most people, a reasonable price to pay.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. One of the things that I find myself talking about quite often when it comes to handling, and it goes back slightly to that point that I made about the Porsche 911, particularly when it has the trick active anti-roll bars fitted, and you know, you can drive some of these modern cars, these modern sports cars, and they feel completely clamped down. They're so glued to the road, their body's so sort of stable and secure that they don't feel exciting to drive, actually. And you find yourself chasing them harder and harder and harder, and they don't ever seem to come and meet you halfway. And so I talk about expressive handling. I want to, when I put a car into a corner, I want to feel what it's doing, even if it's sort of slightly artificial. And a good example of that for me is the Fiesta ST, the current one and the previous one. Because rather than clamp it down, which would be, you know, the sort of Porsche dynamic chassis control method, Ford really allows that car to roll quite markedly. And then also it rotates about its center point, so it yaws. So it does those two things in perfect harmony. And so you turn into a corner and you immediately feel the car working, and being aware, being so conscious of what's going on in a corner, it's just a lovely sensation. And sensations for me is what what driving a performance car is all about. So if it's done well, I do not mind if a car has ever so slightly looser body control, or if it rolls a bit, or if it does a sort of very noticeable yaw movement when you turn into a corner. I think all that stuff is good.
You actively want it, and I suppose we should make a distinction between road and track, but certainly on the road. The Porsche Active roll bars, I had a long-term 991 Carrera S which had it, and I think I switched it on once, and there was nothing about the way it affected the car which I thought it made it in any way better. It basically just, it eliminates roll, which meant the ride disappeared as well. And there's no sensation of turning into a corner. And Mercedes had that system, which I've also tried and turned off instantly, which basically leans the car into the corner. It goes the other way. And that just feels really weird and disconcerting. And to be fair to both manufacturers, you can turn, you don't have to have them. And certainly the Porsche, you have to pay for it if you want it, and probably in the Mercedes too. So, don't tick those boxes. You don't need it. But you're right. I mean, I often talk about cars that breathe with the road, and there's a balance to strike, isn't there? Because you're absolutely right. You don't want a car that feels completely tied down, but nor do you want a car that is pitching and heaving and wallowing. And again, back to the A110 and why we keep on banging on about it. It's just the kind of car that gets that right. It goes with the flow. You can just feel the car gently writhing around without sort of, being either falling over or being sort of, darting and deflecting off every bump because it's got far too great a spring rate or whatever. And to me, that's why I love, Lotuses and that sort of thing, because they've always understood that. Lotus always set their cars up soft. It clearly helps if you've got a light car to begin with, but still, they have a relatively low. I mean, they're not afraid to let their bodies move because ultimately, it's not. And I believe this absolutely fundamentally. It is not how much a car's body moves, how much it, let's say, in roll. It's the rate of the roll that matters. It's how controlled it feels. If you turn into a corner and the car just wants to feels like it's falling over. It's just, gone off the side of a cliff. And that is horrendous. On the other hand, if it doesn't move at all, that's not much better. It's the rate of the roll. And a car can roll, a lot. Things like S-Class Mercedes, actually, when they haven't got the Pendolino thing switched on, do this really, really well. You can get a lot of body roll out of them, but they are controlled so well on their dampers that it's never problematic. It is the rate, not the amount, that matters with these things.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a theory about handling, and particularly in the performance car sector, and it's that handling becomes more and more important as the years go by, because we've already spoken about the sensations of driving, and we know that as we switch to turbocharged engines and paddle shift gearboxes, the sensations from the drivetrain are diminished slightly. And then we look at electric powertrains when there are no gears and when there's no engine sound at all. And all those sensations are lost. So increasingly, we need to draw sensations out of the handling. Without that stuff, electric performance cars, they can be massively fast. But how are they going to be made interesting and exciting to drive? I had a very interesting experience a couple of weeks ago. I was shooting a couple of videos for Car Gurus. I had a 718 Boxster GTS 4-litre and a Taycan Turbo. And we're shooting individual videos on both cars in the same day. And the way that we shoot these videos is we lump together all the different types of sort of footage that we need into one. So I'll do both introductions at the same time. One immediately after the other. And it also means that I'll do all the cornering shots in one car and then immediately switch to the other car. And so I had this really interesting experience of driving through the same sequence of corners probably 20, 25 times in the Boxster and then immediately switching into the Taycan Turbo, which was such an interesting demonstration of the difference between a true and really brilliant driver sports car and an electric car that sort of purports to be a sports car. Porsche sometimes calls it a four-door sports car.
Yeah, so analog and digital.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, the Taycan was no slower through a corner, quicker down a straight. It had just as much grip. But it comes back to this feel thing. Being aware, being a part of that process of a car finding its way through a corner, the Boxster did it beautifully and the Taycan just didn't.
Taycan got the job done very impressively, but it left you emotionally unmoved by it.
Exactly right. Exactly yeah. right. Which is, you know, I certainly don't envy the current generation of engineers who are having to find a way to make electric sports cars genuinely engaging to drive.
And, you know, but the Taycan, and I'm not kidding, probably weighed a ton more than the Boxster.
Thereabouts.
Close to, yeah. You're probably talking about a 1,400 kilo car versus a 2,400 kilo car. And, you know, and sort of going on from that, and in terms, you know, you're talking about how electric cars are making this more difficult and with turbo engines, removing some of the emotion and, you know, the loss of the third pedal in the footwell. But also, you know, almost regardless of the car, you know, they have electric power steering these days and, you know, and they're heavy. And we know very well, don't we, that these are the things that, you know, most affect our driving pleasure. And if you look at all the things that, you know, that we like about cars, I'm going to go back to the Caterham, but you know, you have a car, which it is manual. It has actually completely unassisted steering. It has a normally aspirated engine. It is rear wheel drive. I mean, if you just created a wish list of what you wanted a great handling car to have in terms of its configuration, you make a Caterham. And now you go and you look at modern sporting cars and their turbo engines and their double clutch gearboxes and their weight, and you know, plenty of them have four wheel drive and they all have electric steering and this and that and the other, and you're thinking, you know, all these things are getting in the way. We've gone from a point of view of pure driving pleasure, we have gone in the wrong direction, and I'm afraid largely because that's the direction that the market has taken them in, because you know, we are the exceptions in wanting cars to be the way that we do, and not the rule. But it is a shame. And you know, we talk about, you know, niche products like Caterhams and also more mainstream but still very small volume cars like the GT86 and the A110, and the truth is, the sad truth is that these cars don't do big numbers. You know, these are tiny quantities cut because there just aren't enough people like us for it to be important enough to car manufacturers to pursue those sorts of things in the mainstream. I think they are actually quite good halo cars. I think they're quite good brand builders because I think that they make people feel good about their brands even if they don't own those particular cars, because I think people want to buy a car from a what they would regard as a proper car manufacturer. So I think the fact, oddly enough, that Porsche make GT3 RSs actually helps sell Macans and Cayennes. But, you know, it doesn't not make me sad that that's the way that the world has gone and that we feel increasingly removed from it, and that the best drive I have had in many, many months, you know, has just been in a 1.6-litre car that was designed in 1959.
Yeah, on the GT86, I think we were sat in the same bar in Spain somewhere where a very senior Toyota engineer explained to us that by the skin of its teeth, the GT86 was considered a successful model. You know, the whole project only just sort of wiped its face. And, you know, by such a tiny margin, we know there is going to be a new one, which is great news. And hopefully they'll stick to the same sort of principles and ideology of it not being about speed at all. but about being involving and engaging at even medium and low speeds.
I wonder if your chums at Alpine would feel the same way about the A110.
Yeah, well, we know, don't we, that these cars don't necessarily set the sales charts ablaze, because sadly it seems like there are quite a small number of us who actually prioritise all that stuff.
Yeah, and in the Alpine's case, you know, I don't think they sell a lot of Renaults because of Alpine's, because, you know, it's got a different name and a different look, and, you know, I think out there the perception, there's not that much perception of the connection between the two, but at least with the GT86, you know, there are other Toyotas who may be able to bathe in its reflected glory. I don't know, but no, it is a sale. I think we are very much the exceptions, but, you know, happy to be so.
Yeah, quite. So we've spoken a little bit about new technologies and how they often sort of get in the way of the driving experience. But I think we should quickly acknowledge that with some cars, things like active anti-roll bars and air springs with various ride heights and four-wheel drive systems that can move torque, you know, between the four corners, in certain cars, all those systems confer an advantage. I'm thinking tall cars in particular, SUVs.
Big SUVs, absolutely. Yeah.
Aston Martin DBX is a good case in point of a car with all that technology and it benefits from it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I can remember when I first drove a Bentayga, and I was given a little, they've got this 48 volt system on board, which can vary the roll rate so greatly that effectively, if you were, not that you ever would, but you were driving your Bentayga around a track, there would be no roll. There would be almost, I think they give it a tiny bit, only for those reasons that we were talking about, because it just makes the car feel a little bit more natural on turning. But then, you know, you go into your controller and you summon off-road and you go plugging in your Bentayga again, which you would never ever do. But basically, at that stage, it's effectively, in terms of the way the car behaves, it uncouples the anti-roll bars. So you have you know, all the wheel travel and axle articulation that the car can possibly muster in one environment, and basically none in another. And when you're dealing with cars that are as compromised as big SUVs, because they're so high and they're so heavy, being able to deploy that level of suspension control is absolutely critical. But it's only critical because the cars are so dynamically flawed to begin with. If you were talking about a very low sun car weighing only half a ton, and we may have mentioned one in the course of this podcast, you don't need any of that at all. But then again, you're also not going to go off-roading in a Caterham. Not intentionally, anyway.
Not intentionally, no. A few of us might have done that, but without meaning to. Okay, well, so in conclusion then, I think we're saying that when it comes to handling, lightness and simplicity generally is better. And one of the core fundamental sort of pillars of it is the confidence that it makes you feel as a driver.
Yes, it is absolutely. You can have the most, you know, on paper, dynamically capable car that's ever been created, capable of obliterating Nürburgring lap times. But if you get into it, and when you turn into that first corner, it doesn't keep you fully abreast of conditions underfoot, and you don't feel completely on top of it. And so much more so than ever before, because cars are going so much faster than ever before. They're so much heavier than before, so they have so much more momentum than ever before. If you don't have that confidence, the car has failed at its first job, because, you know, it doesn't matter how fast it is on paper. If in reality you're too bloody frightened to go and, you know, drive it the way it was designed to be driven, then there's absolutely no point having it. So, yeah, but I don't know. It just strikes me as, you know, I'm a slightly changed person after the Caterham drive, but it's so easy, isn't it, for you and I to blase, say, oh, everyone should go and drive a Caterham, and clearly you can't. But, you know, you don't have to drive a Caterham. You know, get into anything that's, you know, light and nice.
An old, you know, MX-5.
You can go and spend a grand on a knackered old MX-5, and 80-90% of the stuff that I'm talking about will be there for you, you know, right then. These are not difficult things to go and experience. And you will find a response and a purity and a feel that you just don't get in a 600 horsepower car weighing 1700 kilos with, you know, four wheel drive and, you know, all the bells and all the whistles. You may well conclude, as indeed I have done, that when it comes to the provision of pure driving pleasure, that the simpler, the lighter, the better. And it's, you know, and everything else is kind of firefighting, isn't it? You know, cars get heavier, so they have to have more suspension control. You know, and cars get bigger and more cumbersome, and, you know, you could just go on and on and on down this road, and people apply more and more electronics to peg it back to re-establish some sense of how they should handle, or stop them handling in a way that they would handle if left to their own devices. Whereas if you just get something that's small and simple and light, it just does it automatically.
We should label this one the Drive Nation Handling Manifesto. I'd be really interested to hear from the listeners and see if people tend to agree with us on this, or if it's just you and I sort of ranting at one another about, you know, what
disappearing
we like
up our own fundaments.
Yeah, exactly. So please do get in touch through Instagram, or you can find us on Twitter or wherever, and just sort of let us know if you think we've got this right, or if we've sort of misunderstood what it is that you lot like about performance cars.
Yeah, that would be really, really good. I mean, it may be that there are lots of you who are thinking, well, hang on a second, guys, you know, I want a car that's really, really fast. I want it to go around corners because I love that impression and that feel of lateral G building, and it's just fun in the same way that getting on a roller coaster is fun. And all this nonsense you bang on about oversteer and understeer and balancing, you know, that's not actually what normal people do. And you know, and if you said that, I might not agree with you, but I'd certainly understand why you said it. So I don't think that any of these things are necessarily to be expressed in terms of right or wrong. It's just what we think. And if you think something's different, then we'd love to hear from you.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see the response to this one. Well, everybody, thank you for listening. As always, please remember to go and give us a glowing review wherever you get your podcast, and a 5-star rating, please. Yeah. We don't want anything less than that, frankly. Remember as well that you can find us on Patreon if you want to bung us a little bit of money each month. Patreon.com/DriveNation, and there is some exclusive content in it for you if you do that. Again, thank you all for listening, and we'll be back with you again next week.
And maybe slightly less geeky next week.
I wouldn't promise that.
We can try.
Okay. Bye, everyone.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states.
UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.